Alrighty, so welcome back to another episode of MedTech Trends. I'm your host, Dorian. So today we have with us Megan Koder, who is the Executive Director of the Digital Therapeutics Alliance. Now, the DTA, as it goes for short, was founded in 2017, and it is a nonprofit trade association of industry leaders, stakeholders engaged in evidence-driven advancement of digital therapeutics. DTA exists to broaden the understanding, adoption, and integration of clinically validated digital therapeutics into healthcare through education, advocacy, and research. So welcome and thanks for joining us today, Megan.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Okay, so I was reading on the DTA website a little bit about how the organization got started, and I know that it currently has a board of directors, pretty stacked, I would say, a really really awesome panel of directors. I'm interested in how this organization got started, essentially, because I think it was October 2017, and how you transitioned from your career. I believe you were working as a pharmacist, or you're a pharmacist by training. How did you transition into DTA?
So let's break that one down. In terms of DTA itself, Pierre Laurent, the CEO of Valentis, had the idea of DTA back in January 2017 during JP Morgan. And during that time, he really recognized the notion of let's try to actually put some definitions and some standards and some rigor around what a digital therapeutic is, especially understanding that this digital health industry is so broad and there's just so many different ways to break down the different types of interventions that are being delivered and or expectations patients and clinicians should be having. So he pulled together about four other CEOs, I believe, in the industry, and they really started their own working group in terms of what this looks like. Weaving myself quickly into that and from the that other side of it, I'm a pharmacist by training, as you mentioned, but I've really worked in the policy association side of this healthcare industry for the last decade or so. In the meantime, I've also been able to work for two different tech startups, one of which was in San Francisco, and then one of which was in Paris, and that was Valentis. So needless to say, within a couple of days of me starting there in May 2017, I learned about DTA, the notion of what it could become, and I really tried to see how it could merge my background with their vision for DTA. I mean, that really grew into a partnership that led to eventually me leaving Valentis pretty quickly to really set up DTA as an independent trade association. And we really grew from there. So I was not the initial notion builder of it, but I was thankfully really being able to be a part of bringing it to life in a really cool way.
You know what? I didn't have a chance to look this up, but I'm curious, how does a trade association work? What does that technically mean?
Yeah, so high level, there's two kinds of associations in the world. There are those that are the professional member side. So that would be in the US terms like the American Pharmacists Association or the American Medical Association, individual practitioners or professionals who come together and really join in this association, whether it's for the sake of education or the association advocating on behalf of their needs or issues up on Capitol Hill or whatever the case is. Trade association means that we have companies that are members, not individuals. So we have a variety of different companies that are part of DTA, ranging all the way from more of your traditional digital therapeutic companies through your pharmaceutical companies, tech companies, and other notions like that. So even though the companies are members of DTA, and that's how we're set up as a nonprofit, all of the individuals in those companies are a part of our day-to-day activity. So it's still very individual oriented, even though it's a company membership, not necessarily an individual membership, from the professional association side.
Okay, gotcha. And I believe there's something like 40 plus growing members.
Yeah, we're about that number.
Okay.
But the great part is we're across 15 countries right now. So the notion that we're building is digital therapeutics should be looked at the same way that they are across all these different regions. They should have the same level of quality. You shouldn't be able to, as a company, deliver the same product in one country's claiming to do all these great, fantastic things, and then have different claims in another country just because the regulatory standards aren't the same or because the industry standards aren't there. So we're really looking at harmonizing this to ensure that there's clinical efficacy and quality management systems and human engagement and end user testing and all of these other ideas really across the board, no matter which country or region they're used in. We want to have that same level of rigor across all of these areas.
And we'll touch quite a bit more on how DTA is doing its work and some of the position statements that it's put together over the last couple of years. There's one thing that I'm really curious to get your take on, even if it's just in general, so if you can't speak to the particular product out there, but because you have a pharmacy background, there's been a lot of work over the years in terms of streamlining pharmacy services, and then also kind of expanding the way that pharmacists can get involved in a patient's care, for good reasons, I think. And I'm curious if there's a group or a type of digital therapeutics that really interests you or excites you, at least, you know, at this point in time.
So I think it may be helpful, and I apologize if you're going to already be heading that direction soon, but just what even is a digital therapeutic? And I think a lot of people understand the general notion about it, but I think it's important just to level set that we are looking at products that are using software to generate and deliver a medical intervention to a patient, clinical intervention. And that intervention has to make the claim to prevent, manage, or treat a disease or disorder. So that said, we're not looking at those that are purely on the adherence side or purely on the monitoring or purely diagnostic or even clinical decision support. So that said, in our space, digital therapeutics have so much potential to be a part of a pharmacist or diabetes educator workflow or nurse practitioner or physician or all of these different types of clinicians. I think on the pharmacist side, one of the cool things is that, again, pharmacists interact with patients on a fairly ongoing basis. Obviously, some changes are happening with different notions of mail order pharmacy. So patients may be able to get their medications at home. That said, they'll always have access to a line where they can call in and talk to a pharmacist and ask questions and really clarify what's taking place there. So I think from the side of the pharmacist, if pharmacists are given access to some of this data, well, that'd be amazing, because then all of a sudden you can tell if a patient's on an inhaler, how are they doing that inhaler? Are there any changes? Are they using the inhalers in a better manner in terms of they're using their maintenance inhaler appropriately and not using the rescue inhaler as often once they've learned their triggers? Diabetes, I think it's really similar too. If you have a patient who's newly on insulin, having the insight from digital therapeutic, helping coach and tell that patient exactly, you need to now take this many units of insulin based upon your last reading and your glucose levels and your last dose. Those things would all be helpful for pharmacists. At the earlier level, though, I think it's even the notion of, I see you're on this digital therapeutic. How's it working? Is it engaging? Have you really benefited from the experience? Just even engaging with the patients at that level, I think is important. And then the last one to bring up is a number of these products, digital therapeutics, they can be prescription or non-prescription only. A variety of implications arise from that. But if you do have a prescription therapeutic and it's being dispensed through a specialty pharmacy, then you have a lot of pharmacists who are actually dispensing these products and educating the patients on what to expect and what to look for and do. So it's already a part of their clinical workflow. And I think we'll continue to see that notion grow into more of the traditional mainstream pharmacy areas also.
Yeah, you touched on a couple of points that I wanted to ask you about too. So let's see if I can break this down in a couple of different ways. So, as soon as you mentioned the idea of the patient education, I thought that was kind of interesting as something that could help to folks to distinguish and think about digital therapeutics differently than, say, you know, a simple support tool, an education tool. There's quite a few communities that have come out for different therapy areas. So a digital therapeutic in the way that it is defined, I'm kind of paraphrasing here from a DTA perspective, and there's a paper or a guideline that you guys have on your website, super helpful. So I'd encourage people to go and check that out. But it has to be an evidence-backed tool that can be used to actually as a medical or clinical intervention. So it is something that's tested. It would actually, to qualify for a digital therapeutic in this sense, you would have to have gone through trials and some sort of approval through a regulatory body. Is that roughly it?
Yeah, it's the notion of if I have a wellness product that is going to make somebody feel happier and more whole in the next couple of days or weeks, that is fantastic. But as soon as I start to make the claim saying, I'm going to actually treat your depression, or I'm going to start to treat aspects of your PTSD, or we're going to actually change the direction of your multiple sclerosis symptoms, and whatever those other notions are, you need to be able to back that up. you need to make sure it's safe, that's effective, that it's patient-centric, that it's delivering on the outcomes it has claimed to do, and then that it's also going to be reliable. In the long term, you need to see that it's going to keep doing the work it needs to keep doing. So I think there are those distinctions even of, let's help patients understand what the different types of products out there are. Digital therapeutics, we're talking about, again, medical interventions being delivered to a patient via software. But that doesn't mean that they can't work alongside of wearables and adherence products or monitoring tools or clinical decision support, or even provide secondary benefits of those for the patients and clinicians engaging with them. So it's a complex ecosystem, but it really does boil down to that notion of what is the product claiming to do? And therefore then based upon those claims, that will determine then its level of regulatory oversight required or the level of clinical evidence required. And general digital therapeutics are in that higher category of both evidence and regulatory oversight.
I imagine also that, so obviously being able to have a categorization system, a nomenclature system, if you will, extremely important for being able to move the dialogue forward and to simplify matters where they can be simplified to talk about these things. I think that that sort of thing also really becomes important from a regulatory perspective, from a reimbursement discussion perspective as well. So, you know, it's good that there's a very recognized body like DTA to put out these sort of position statements and guidelines and other sorts of papers as well. To be able to help folks actually get through these kinds of conversations, because it does require a shift in thinking from a couple of different perspectives, a healthcare provider perspective, payer perspective, reimbursement agency perspective, and also clinical and patients. Like, how should a clinician think about a digital therapeutic that, you know, are they prescribing it? Is it kind of like prescribing a medication? Is there such thing as an over-the-counter or generic version of a digital therapeutic? Is it like some of those concepts are, it's hard to draw a parallel with something much more familiar like a medicine.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, when you're looking at digital therapeutics, you have a lot of similarities that people may not think of right away. You have a mechanism of action. How is it delivering the intervention? So even though it's a digital, not a chemical, you still have that. You also have active and inactive ingredients. There are parts of a digital therapeutic that are there to keep the product running and keep things moving, but they're not central to necessarily delivering that core mechanism of action or intervention. So that there's a lot of different ways to think about it. And we even engaged with the US Pharmacopeia in 2017, really looking at this idea around what could a monograph look like for a digital therapeutic in the same way that you have for a medication. And in traditional drug world, again, my background's a pharmacist, you do dissolution tests. You're not going to do a dissolution test and put the software and hardware into water and see how quickly it dissolves. But there are other tests you do need to do. So what are those? And how would somebody know if you have a counterfeit digital therapeutic or an adulterated digital therapeutic? So those notions do apply. I don't think we're in the realm yet of a generic digital therapeutic. These are complex platforms with complex systems. So instead of just saying, hey, we're the generic version of this or that, we've seen a lot more companies say, take diabetes, for example. There are many different ways to address diabetes. There are many different patient groups and many different languages in which to do it and different approaches and aspects of the condition to address. So we haven't seen, we've seen a lot of innovation across the board. We haven't seen someone come and say, we're just doing what they do and that's it, full stop. And that's probably going to be hard to do given just how much of a complex system that you're creating around the experience. Whereas medication, it's fairly straightforward. There's not much of a patient experience with it, aside from injectables and other things that obviously the patient has to engage in, but they're not being immersed into something either, a new environment or whatever the case is, whether it's done virtually or via hardware or software, whatever the case is. So it's a cool system. There's a lot of similarities in terms of the science, but then obviously in terms of the delivery, there are going to be pretty significant differences.
There's actually, yeah, there's so much actually interesting in what you just said there too. The one part that I definitely want to come back to is the idea of patient experience, particularly for patients that have been traditionally underserved. You know, there's a whole body of work around folks that you know, have been very hard to reach. And that has impacted health. And so there are, it contributes to health inequality. So I do want to come back to that point.
Yeah, I would love to.
Definitely. So, you know, since it's been founded in 2017. Obviously, there's been a lot of work at DTA in terms of standardizing and providing some kind of systematic approach for thinking about and adopting digital therapeutics into normal practice. Some of the work that you guys have created, it's on your website. And again, I encourage folks to check it out. It's great to read and be aware of. So you have, core principles of digital therapeutics. You have a document defining different categories of digital therapeutics. Mm-hmm. There's a code of ethics, an industry code of ethics. There are several guidance statements for payers and providers and so on. All of that, I think, is even more relevant today, meaning as of about a year ago and moving forward because of the pandemic, where there's been a boom in digital therapeutics. The number of startups has kind of skyrocketed. I think in mental health alone, there's like 1,500 plus 2,000 digital apps, I should say, some of which may be digital therapeutics. How has the pandemic accelerated, if I can call it that, the uptake of digital therapeutics? And do you see any need for updating or revising any of the statements from DTA?
So when you look at what we put together in 2018 and 2017 was really the notion of, if you're going to begin, I mentioned this earlier, but if you're going to be making a medical claim, what do you have to do to ensure that the product is safe, effective, rigorous, and reliable, and all these other notions? Those principles have not changed, and I don't foresee them changing too significantly either. I think we really get to the core issues around, they have to be built reliably. They have to have quality management processes in place. They have to undergo clinical trials to demonstrate initial safety and impact, but then ongoing real-world evidence generation for efficacy and effectiveness in the real-world environment. So I don't see those principles changing per se. What I have seen evolve, though, is the need for payers to say, we really need to address this and let's try to figure out how to do it. But what questions should we be asking and how should we approach this? And what is that type of a framework? So to be honest, I haven't seen a need to actually shift what our core principles are or our definition is of this. But I have seen a need from a payer perspective, as an example, or a clinician perspective of, we need more insight and intel to understand this in an ongoing everyday basis. So that's some of the work that we're doing right now. I think in terms of these other notions around these definitions, the definition I think is still just digital therapeutics will be here, I think, for the rest of our lives and far beyond. Software engaged in delivering intervention to a patient in a remote or other setting, that's going to be here. What name they go by, though, in the next 10 years, if we drop the digital component, fantastic, because then all of a sudden the recognition is there of, oh, these are just therapies. So I can prescribe insulin alongside of a digital therapeutic, or I can prescribe an inhaler alongside of digital therapeutic, or for a child with ADHD, maybe I start them on a digital product and then we advance them to medication, or start medication advanced to digital therapeutic. It's all this notion that you have medications working alongside of and with digital therapeutics and other in-person therapies. So it's a much more of a cohesive system now of delivering care, as opposed to just, I only have medications, biologics, proteins to deliver to a patient. You now have the ability to actually augment and even in some cases replace therapies and or deliver therapies that have never existed before and touch on disease states that have never been able to be addressed. That's what's cool about this industry.
Mm-hmm. I'm just as excited as you are. So there was one part that that I'm also curious to get your perspective on. Again, this acceleration of digital therapeutics on the reimbursement side of things. I'm kind of putting you on the spot a little bit, but is there a trend, like a noteworthy trend in terms of successful, reimbursement of digital therapeutics? Is there an uptake?
So great question. And taking this from a global perspective, I think that's the best place to start. We've seen an ongoing evolution. So in 2018, I want to say March 2019 too, possibly, I should know my dates. In the UK, NICE put out, and NICE is their the UK's weight grouped from HTA body. They're the ones to evaluate the affordability of these products and all of these other aspects that go into it. But they put out their guidelines. It's evidence for effectiveness. And they were the first ones to say, from a payer perspective, if you're going to be in one of these three tiers, here are the different levels of risk associated with these three tiers, and therefore the levels of evidence that you need to have for us to be able to properly evaluate and then be able to give the approvals to NHS to actually cover these inpatient populations. So they started this discussion at that national level. More recently, we've seen Germany take on this incredible legislative package where now digital therapeutics, among other digital health products, and their term is DIGA. So it's almost a Venn diagram. Not all digital therapeutics are DIGA and not all DIGA are digital therapeutics. But there's a subset of them now that are being paid for on a national level and being made available to the entire population of Germany once they've gone through this process. So we've seen national efforts underway. In the United States, we've seen the growth of different formularies. So again, Express Scripts through their now new division Evernorth, they have a digital health formulary, which includes some digital therapeutics. CVS Health, very similar. I've heard similar efforts within Cigna. So there's a lot of interest in this, but there's no one-size-fits-all business model for the payment of a digital therapeutic, but neither is there a one-size-fits-all digital therapeutic either. So you have digital therapeutics that can be covered by employers, those, and because they're focused on employees and their employer needs. You have digital therapeutics that are within clinics, so health systems will take this on. Those that are focused on different indications and aspects of patient populations. So you have different payers interested in different areas. And as such, then you have different payment systems from each of these different types of product lines.
And DTA is also involved in, like you said, 15 countries, I believe it was.
We have members in 15 different countries, and they probably work in even more countries than that.
Okay, gotcha. I'm really curious to get your take also on, you know, some of this work around reimbursement going on in other countries as well as the U.S. Like how can DTA facilitate, you know, maybe moderate some of these discussions or provide certain guidance on how to develop a reimbursement, you know, plan or an HTA set of guidelines, something like that? Is that part of the work that DTA is doing?
In some regards, yes, but we also have to make sure that we're not overstepping our mandate either. So I don't know if I've defined it, but HTA is a health technology assessment process, and it's very much the way that these different national levels, especially in Europe and some other regions too, will evaluate what these products are. So on the European side, just again, a quick step back, products will go through a notified body process, get their CE mark at the EU level, then they'll go to the individual countries. And that is where they'll either have to register with the local regulatory authority and then undergo this HTA evaluation process. One of the things that we've been working on is trying to figure out how do we bring these HTA bodies together and just start to talk about these notions of what are the commonalities and what are the similarities and what are the differences. And one of the conversation points we found is that all of these different entities require some level of clinical evidence, as they should, but there's different levels of clinical evidence and there's different ways to describe that. So one of the things that we would love to just dive into more with us or these individual HTA bodies and anyone else who's in this realm is really that discussion around what do these different types of evidence mean? And are they so different that a company would need to do another entire RCT to even enter that country? Or can the data that's already been done be applied, and or are there additional add-on studies that need to be done for authorization in these countries? So it's still that notion of scalability and cross-border usability that we're still somewhat concerned about, because as these countries are starting to figure out their own paradigms, it's fantastic to see the growth. But if they're going to be so different, then we're going to realize that digital therapeutics will hit wall after wall and not actually be able to reach the patient populations in these different regions, potentially based upon just like a regulatory requirement that may not have been defined in alignment with some of the others out there. So one example of an area that I'm intrigued by that we're starting some work on, but there's a lot more to accomplish in that regard.
I can imagine. Again, this stuff is, you know, I want to give people a sense that, you know, an appreciation of just how, you know, DTA, digital therapeutics have been around for about 10 years or so, give or take. But yeah. I mean, everything's really accelerated, and the available options out there right now are many, many fold larger than they were just a couple of years ago. So a lot of this is brand new. And I imagine that there's quite a bit of work that needs to go into, you know, establishing some kind of standard way to look at and to evaluate digital therapeutics before they can actually be adopted by, you know, large bodies, large populations, and reimbursed as such too. There seem to be some similarities though that we can draw from, you know, HTA work in medical devices or you know, prescription medications. I know that's not the main topic of this talk, but you know, there already are guidelines and processes and a long history of that type of work. Mm-hmm. So I imagine there's probably something that can be borrowed from those worlds, the prescription drug world and the medical device world.
Yeah, very much so. So digital therapeutics, by and large, are medical devices. So they really do fit on that side of the aisle when it comes to regulatory agencies. So in the United States, they are reviewed and cleared by CDRH and not CDER generally. CDER is more on the drug side. Digital therapeutics are on the device side. There are some growing instances, though, where you're starting to see companion products or products that are in combination even. So it's still a small area and percentage of the industry, but we are starting to see more, some more drug regulatory agency engagement in the evaluation of digital therapeutics. That said, once they've moved beyond that initial regulatory review phase, that is when we're starting to recognize that, yes, digital therapeutics are medical devices, but they work alongside of and in conjunction with medications. So that line starts to blur a bit in terms of what is the impact? What is the outcome? What's the clinical efficacy? That same efficacy and impact could be delivered just as well or possibly better or not by a digital therapeutic as it would be by medication. So it's really important, I think, for clinicians to recognize that these are therapeutics and they have to look at the clinical trial data and the real-world evidence outcomes to really assess, is this the right patient at the right time? Ask very similar questions to what you would for a traditional medication. So that line blurs, I think, once you get to practice, once you are more focused on the outcomes being delivered by these products.
That's really interesting. I actually did not know that they would fall under the medical device umbrella, roughly. Okay, but I can totally see the potential overlap here with let's see, pharmaceutical companies that want to provide additional support for the therapeutics with a digital therapeutic sort of working mm-hmm. parallel or alongside as a package. Really interesting stuff. Okay. So I want to get your take on are there countries that are ahead of the game in terms of reimbursing and having a really good process in place for approving digital therapeutics, and are there countries that are lagging behind or haven't thought as much about digital therapeutics?
So I feel like I've already shared the answer, and I'm going to somewhat just repeat what I already have. I think just going back to some of the things you mentioned earlier, this is still really early in terms of, if you look at the entire life cycle and lifespan, I should say, of the drug industry, there's been a lot more time to figure a lot of these things out and create harmonization. One of the things I have appreciated is there's a group called IMDRF, and they are an entity that is formed of international medical advice regulatory agencies that have come together across multiple regions to really look at, on the medical device side, how do we start to evaluate these products? And digital therapeutics being a subset of one of their notions, software as a medical device was one of the regulations that was, or regulatory notions that was put forth by IMDRF. Even before DTA was founded. So the notion that they came up with is, how do we start to evaluate software as a medical device, knowing that these products are going to iterate and they're going to improve? Again, going back to my pharmacy roots, in general, medications, once they hit the market and they've received approval from a regulatory agency, they generally don't change and they don't evolve and they don't modify themselves or become modified to better meet patient needs or to better address aspects that could be improved upon. Digital therapeutics, they have that ability and are really almost required to do that in terms of getting in product performance data, getting in clinical outcomes from patients, and making sure that the products are functioning at the right time and the right pace at the right speed and meeting those outcomes and metrics. So all of that to say, IMDRF pulled this group together to create SAMD. And part of the SAMD framework is this idea of an iterative approach. And while I think SAMD is fantastic, it could probably be updated eventually. The notions, I think, are being adopted more globally, which is really helpful to see. So South Korea, as I mentioned, they just put out this notion around digital therapeutics in August, actually in light of COVID. They're very focused on basing this upon the SAMD framework. FDA, all of their programs are very strongly based on the SAMDI framework. So it's nice to at least have this one group that has kept an international focus and has brought some degree of harmonization to these areas.
All really good to hear. I mean, yeah, a lot of the stuff is happening, but I think we need to draw more attention to it because like you said, I think from the start of this this podcast, a lot of this is here to stay, and the uptake mm-hmm. is going to increase over time, and for good reasons, I think. You know, a lot of this talk is actually centered around the idea of you know, expanding access to useful therapies to people that have traditionally not had very easy access to these therapies. And you know, there's also a plug in here for a white paper that DTA recently produced. I believe it's called Reducing Health Inequalities, Rural Health Inequalities. And a lot of the paper is actually focused on, you know, identifying very good use cases of digital therapeutics and how that can help to address some of the leading causes of health-related death and disease in populations, again, that have traditionally not had a great access to therapies, digital therapeutics or otherwise. So now I'm curious, from, you know, a policy and a reimbursement perspective, you would think that digital therapeutics is a quick sell, and that would obviously help to accelerate access to care for rural populations. Are there any barriers that are still sort of slowing down the uptake of digital therapeutics, particularly in those populations? Or, you know, is this kind of like
a
natural process? One in particular? Okay.
So as you're rightfully pointing out, rural health is just one example, but I think digital therapeutics, and I'm speaking about this globally, and then I'll bring it back to the United States in just a moment. Digital therapeutics have the ability to deliver therapy that is clinically validated and aligned with all these other notions around clinical guidelines to patients, anyone who has access to any form of internet, be it intermittent or broadband access. I think many of these digital therapeutics don't all require broadband, as an example, but you have the ability to deliver therapies to patients on smartphones, on tablets, on computer devices. And you can do that to patients that are in underserved areas or that are in city centers that just don't have access to clinicians all the time, or rural health as an example too. So the global health side of me loves the notion of knowing all the potential that we could do from those patients also in low and middle income countries who may not have access to consistent therapies and treatments. And this could be one way to really deliver that. So that part just fascinates me about all the potential the industry has. In the United States more specifically, there's one barrier that really gets in the way right now and that we've been trying to really focus on. And it's the notion that at the private level, on the private side, healthcare insurers and employers are generally able to cover these. They're able to figure out pathways to provide access to their patients as appropriate, and that's increasing. On the public side, however, Medicare does not have a way to recognize digital therapeutics. Since there's no benefit category, similar to Medicare can recognize drugs, they can recognize a lot of different types of products, but their guidelines were developed before digital therapeutics were. So there's no benefit category for digital therapeutics, and therefore then any population covered by Medicare simply does not have access to digital therapeutics. Medicaid, it's very similar. Digital therapeutics are by and large not covered by Medicaid. There are a couple of states that are really taking some interesting efforts. There's an article in Health Affairs that came out recently. I'm happy to share with you and listeners with that, that are looking at innovative Medicaid programs and ways that they're trying to go about it. But until these public payers in the United States have a mechanism to actually recognize and then eventually provide access to these products, anyone who's covered by Medicare, Medicaid generally doesn't receive these. There's a lot of patients that have that could greatly benefit from a digital therapy in this regard who just right now don't have that option.
Really interesting you point that out too. And I know you have an interest in health policy as well. There was it's not a very long white paper, really nicely kind of put together. So again, I'd encourage readers to, or viewers to actually go and check that out. And toward the end of it, I think one of the recommendations, if you will, the conclusions of that white paper, it calls on, or it encourages legislatures, mm-hmm. Legislators to direct CMS to recognize, codify, and reimburse digital therapeutics. And, you know, I'm wondering, is there, how, how much effort is being put toward that, from a CMS perspective? And is there anything that, are there particular challenges to encouraging legislators to do that?
Well, we started this with a good degree of intensity last year in 2020. And when we were first on the Hill, there was really minimal understanding about what these are. Aren't all digital health apps the same? They really don't need to account for patient privacy and security, right? So it took us a while to actually say, nope, digital therapeutics, they're different from these different types of products you may hear about. They are all under HIPAA. They are all ensuring patient security and privacy. That's part of their mandate, basically, as a digital therapeutic. So there's a lot of education we did just to bring them up to speed on that. And they're really receptive to the notion. So much so that by the end of December, we were talking with one of the main committees who would actually have this jurisdiction. And he basically said to us, like, we would love to do this. Every single one of our members thinks this is a great idea. But it came down to bandwidth. There are so many other priorities right now on the Hill that they're worried about what's going on within their hospitals and what's taking place with from the vaccine perspective, all these other notions. So while we went from a very low level understanding to an incredibly high one where they're like, yes, this is what we need. It was just a hard time because there's so many other priorities right now, and as there should be. So I think that there's interest to do this and do it well. But when that's going to happen, we're still waiting to see.
So, ongoing progress. Mm-hmm. And I can appreciate all the competing priorities, especially in times like this. To my mind, I think one of the big values of digital therapeutics here is the potential to address population health. That's cost savings. Yeah. I mean, there's huge potential for doing this. And, so it sounds like there isn't much trouble in communicating the value of digital therapeutics, but there are competing priorities right now. And that might be one of the factors that kind of, reduces the pace at which digital therapeutics could really be taken up. And so maybe we're not seeing their full potential, I think, at this point. Would that be fair to say?
There's so much more potential this industry has to offer. I would agree. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a number of companies. So you mentioned digital therapeutics have been on the market for at least 10 years. And those companies that have that longer tenure already, they have 30 to 45 studies each, really demonstrating not only just initial safety and impact, but then impact within specific patient populations in specific regions, and then cost savings and healthcare impact on cost, and then reduction of emergency room visits and all of this. So that alone, I think, is of interest. On the population health side, one of my favorite studies that's been done was the city of Louisville, Kentucky, partnered with one of our member companies, and they did a population health study, and not even intending to do it as much, I think, right off the bat. But what they were able to find was by giving this product to these different individuals across the city for the benefit of their asthma and COPD, they were able to start to track it at an aggregate level. And they actually could tell in different corners of the city where patients were doing better, and even narrowed it down to the idea in some areas. And for those listening, please read the study yourself. It's in, I believe, Health Affairs also, to make sure that I'm not misrepresenting. But basically, they're able to say, children walking or people walking on this pathway to their areas of work or school had worse outcomes because it was going by different plants and other industry type areas with a lot of truck exhaust and all that notion. Whereas those in the other part of the city, where they had more tree lined streets and all these other benefits in terms of just environmental side, they did better. And they were able to actually identify, here's how we as a city planning entity can actually make changes to benefit the health of our population. And that notion alone was so cool because it's not only using digital therapeutics to deliver therapies to individual patients, but you're also now looking at how do we actually impact the entire health of our city or our region? And what can we do that's not health related directly necessarily, but that'll have a direct impact on people's health? So digital therapeutics have so many opportunities to really use this data in a meaningful way.
This reminds me, how can an individual consumer, if you will, because I imagine a lot of digital therapeutics, I mean, some of these things are going to have platforms or APIs, let's say, for big organizations to tap into. So, city planning committees, hospitals, hospital systems. And then we get into like the, sort of the smaller areas that they might kind of fall into. So private practices, small practices, yeah. and then the average consumer as well. Like I might want to download certain apps that I know that either I've been recommended or prescribed, or that I simply want to use myself. I imagine that every one of these stakeholders is sort of thinking about digital therapeutics in a slightly different way. But from, you know, an individual patient's perspective, how should I kind of think about this? You know, is it, again, it's a little bit different than, you know, a medical device like a pacemaker or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's also very different than a prescription. I don't have a pill bottle that I can, you know, take once a day type of thing. So, you know, how can a patient sort of think about a digital therapeutic?
You touch on so many different aspects. So one of the first aspects I want to mention, in terms of dosing. So different digital therapeutics are intended for different lengths of time. So some of them are 12-week program. Some of them will be for 30 days for a specific number of minutes or hours in a day. So whatever the case is, there's oftentimes a different dosing regimen that comes along with it. So you mentioned, I don't have a pill bottle. I can't take it once a day. But in fact, some of these, you actually are supposed to do that. And there are others though that are more use at your own will in terms of when you need it, we're here for you. But I think the critical component is still going back to that notion, you're delivering a therapy. So the idea of the right patient at the right time is important. So much so that I haven't seen many, if any, digital therapy, well, maybe a handful. By and large, very few digital therapeutics will go as a direct to a consumer pathway where you're just available and you're there and patients can download them and use them at will. What generally happens is that since these are therapies, since they need to have some level of direct validation or authorization for a patient, they'll go through an employer. So an employer will identify patients who have this condition with this level of acuity and make those products available to those employees. Or you'll see healthcare payers identifying very similarly. Patients with a specific indication, here are the reasons why we were going to give it to you. Here are the benefits we're expecting. Here are this list of criteria, and then they'll make it available to those patients. When it's more on the prescription side, obviously it's going to be a clinician saying, here's a written prescription. Here's how you go about downloading the product, gain access, and then using it in a meaningful way. So it's different than a traditional, I'm just going to go to an app store and download a product. In many cases, even if you do go to an app store, you can find the shell of the product, but you're going to likely need an authorization code or some other way to access the entirety of the product. And then that, once you access that, it's going to be personalized to you and you'll get the data and the insights. And then as appropriate, if necessary, it'll send those data and insights to the clinician you're working with. So it's much more of an ecosystem built around a patient, a very similar approach that you would for medication. Think of it more traditional pharmacist generated medication, as opposed to like an over-the-counter, hey, this looks good. I'll just use it for now and see if it gets any better.
You're also touching on a lot of really interesting things. I mean, we can have entire conversations just on these individual topics. You mentioned the ecosystem aspect, all of this. There's a reason I think that even the idea of a digital health ecosystem has become really popular. You know, I've seen a lot of articles and papers by, you know, think tank type organizations sort of touching on the fact that there's just so many point solutions out there and so many companies coming up with their own versions of mm-hmm. very similar things. You know, at some point, these things have to be kind of put together, packaged into something totally that is you. Much more comprehensive. If not, yep. it'll be like the app store. I think there's something like 300,000, 400,000 health apps, something like that.
I think that's so outdated, but that's the number I'm still using too. yeah. Because I think at QVC Mountain, we've all said it since 2018. So it's grown since then.
Probably a lot more. Yeah. And even within the digital therapeutic space, so this is a very small niche evidence-based really subset. You know, even there, you still have a lot of different apps and quite a few of them are still point solutions. So for a particular therapy area, particular symptoms, particular diseases, is this eventually going to be rolled into some kind of digital ecosystem, almost like a digital hospital is the way that I would kind of liken it to?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. One of the things I've seen start developing is we have a number of companies, and I'll start with more of the diabetes notion. Dario Health and WellDoc, I think, are good examples of this, where they started in one area and are starting to add in additional components or different disease state notions. So all of a sudden you have more of a suite of products that are able to address possible comorbidities if appropriate to that patient. Obviously, they wouldn't be upgraded or introduced into those areas if they didn't have the other comorbidities. So there is the notion that even within a single digital health, digital therapeutic platform, that the indications that the product is able to address will continue to expand, and therefore patients can have access to the things that are more tangential to their diabetes. So there is that notion. I really would love to see more of a platform approach developed, to exactly your point. One of my curiosities, and I bring this up randomly, but the notion, because of pharmacist again, I brought this up like 18 times today, but drug-drug interactions are huge. So you have to worry about every single drug you take and so forth. Digital therapeutic interactions, there are some digital therapeutics that may interact with different drugs or that should not be used while a different drug is being used. But then there's also this notion of a DTX-DTX interaction. If you're using two therapies with the same mechanism of action, albeit for very different indications, is that the right thing to start a patient on two of them at the same time? Or should they be separated? And I throw 6 weeks out as a very random number. There's no science behind it. But should you start one product on six first, and then 6 weeks later, you start the next digital therapeutic? Should it be 8 weeks? Should it be 12? What is that cadence? And how can you start to use these more cohesively together? Those are the types of things that I think not only will pharmacists and other clinicians become engaged in, but having a system that's AI/ML based, really able to help identify all these things, I think will have to be a part of the future.
I think you're also touching on the idea of personalized precision medicine genomics and interactions between drugs.
It all
and
should be together.
Everything.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
How
exactly.
That's created, so, though, I'm still waiting to find that out.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of people are. Yeah. Definitely. Really, really fascinating stuff. I mean, we can have a whole conversation on that topic alone. So I know we're running a little bit short on time. There's a part that I wanted to see if we can end on here, because I think it's a really important note to reemphasize. DTA seems to have a focus or a growing interest in addressing rural health inequalities, underserviced populations, high burden populations using digital therapeutics. And I wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit, from a policy perspective, was that the interest? Because it has a potentially huge policy implications, and at the same time, there's huge room to address population health issues and have a major impact. Is that part of the thinking behind that?
Oh, that's an interesting question, just even in terms of why we're doing it. There's so many reasons. I guess I haven't really verbalized them thoroughly before, so this will be my attempt at conciseness, but I'm sure I'm missing entire areas of it. When we're looking at this, it's just the notion that all patients should deserve the same level of treatment and they should deserve the same level of medical therapy. And I think this is one of those times where we can actually start to deliver standardized, consistent therapies to patients who may not have access to it. And whether that access is denied to them because of a geographic issue or because they're living in an area that just doesn't have the medical services available to them, or because it's of language or cultural considerations or any of those other notions, those are all the reasons that I think we as an industry see so much potential and really want to engage in that. How patients get access to it is going to be really important. There are some notions around so many people have a smartphone, and I've seen a variety of statistics all the way from like 90 to 70% people, but that also includes those in lower middle income countries that smartphone access is really widely available. So there are things that we need to take into consideration. And I pick on atorvastatin a lot, but atorvastatin as an example of medication, it does not need to speak Spanish. It does not need to speak Swahili. Digital therapeutics, they do. If they're being used in a specific region for patients who that is their primary language, they need to be designed in a way to actually speak these languages and address the patients in their own cultural understandings. So there are some considerations that we at the industry level, each company needs to address. The policy level, though, it's so brilliant how you can make a smart policy move and then therefore just enable access to patients in a way that they've never had access to therapy before. And again, you're bringing them into the therapy and you're giving them data and you're giving them insights so they have ownership of it. And then you're enabling clinicians to be part of that discussion and really use that data to optimize therapy. I think the entire purpose of all this, in my mind at least, is the optimization of therapy. So you can use all these data and insights generated from a digital therapeutic to not only optimize the digital therapeutics intervention, but also the other medications and also the notions of the in-person therapy. You can find out patient-reported outcomes. So in like the potential there is this like utopia in my mind. And we're taking steps toward that. But I think it's really this notion of really creating a fair playing field for everyone to have access to the same level of care. And I think this is one modality that really has the potential to do it.
And I agree with you. So
thanks. I'm glad here.
Yeah, it's really
the sense are welcome too.
Yeah, exactly. This is I think some people have called it kind of a silver lining to what's happened over the last year with the pandemic. But you know, if there is a bit of a bright side, is that at least in this context, you know, these digital therapeutics are expanding at a very rapid pace, and there's a lot of potential to do a lot of good coming out of this whenever we do come out of it. And you know, it's interesting, and there's a lot to look forward to. So
yeah, I think there was just a point you're making. Digital therapeutics, they're not going to treat COVID. That is not their purpose. But for the mental health conditions and the chronic disease issues that people are having, they are perfect for that. And I think people are recognizing that, and that trajectory will only continue to grow, especially once we emerge from more of this acute phase. Lord willing, that comes soon. But as we emerge from this phase, I think the notions that we've been seeing in literature and articles is mental health crisis is really, truly growing. And opiate addiction and alcohol abuse disorders and all these other notions, in addition then to the chronic diseases that may have been overlooked or not able to be addressed as well during the COVID emergency time. So digital therapeutics really need to be a key component of that discussion. Payers, policymakers are recognizing the value, but they also need tools to be able to do that. And I think part of DTA, our mandate, hopefully, is helping provide some of those tools to ease that, really that onboarding and use of these products globally.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay, Megan, it's been awesome having a chance to talk to you about digital therapeutics and the Digital Therapeutics Alliance. Again, I wish we can keep this conversation going for a while longer, but I know we're limited on time. I'd love to have you come back on at some point, and you know, as more things happen with the DTA and with the entire market globally and locally as well, it's going to be interesting. And you know, I definitely enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful to be able to talk about this with you.
All right. We'll catch you next time. Thanks so much.